Well, hello there, and welcome to True Crime Bones. With me, your host Marissa, also known as Bones. So, for today's episode, I decided, since the previous episode, you know, we did some time travel and went all the way back to 1956 and 7. Since we're there, why not do another one from that, well, not that exact time, but like an old one. I mean, we did all the work to time travel, so why not? So in this episode, which will be two-part, we will be talking about the murder of the 34-year-old Tom Waldeck, which was known as the Waldeck Affair. And this took place in 1965. Now, so we moved on a little bit. But before I get into it, I would just like to say, True Crime Bones is on Patreon. And if you would like to support this podcast and the Instagram page, truecrime.bones, where I do try and post daily true crime stories of South Africa and what's going on now. You know, it's what the cases are like. Maybe when I post them, it happened day, two, 3 days before I posted. You know, so it's fresh, it's new, and it's content you've never seen before. And I would like to do that more frequently, even be able to do that, as well as this podcast, better quality, you know, two more episodes, because I know the release of each episode is, there's quite a long wait in between, I'm sorry. But a lot of research in each, and because the cases, most of them are so new, or this case so old, it's not as easy to find the information. It takes a lot of time and translation from Afrikaans to English, because unfortunately I do not have any of like podcasting equipment, like even a mic or anything like that. I have to wait a certain time of day and just have a few, like an hour or so, use the bathroom to you know, record, which is hard. So I'm able to, or well, I would love to be able to make more content, you know, frequently, share so much, and for that I need you guys' support in enabling me to be able to get an actual mic. So with that, more episodes, and they will be more frequently and much better quality. So if that's something you would like to help me with, you know, make it like one person's dream come true, please, and if you are able, check out the Patreon. There's 4 tiers options. There's just like a dollar, and each dollar counts, trust me, every little bit helps. So the links, if you can, if you're able, and you just, or you just want to check out, because you'll get some great behind, like extra content and so much more. The link will be available in the description, as well as on the truecrime.bones Instagram page in the bio. With that said, let's get into this episode. At 7 p.m. on June 29th, 1965, the Waldeck family, Tom, his dark-haired, vivacious wife, Corris, and their 2 young sons sat down to have dinner in their plush house in Aaron Avenue, Melrose, Johannesburg, South Africa. That's when the telephone rang, and Tom Waldeck got up and he spoke on the phone for like 5 minutes. Apparently it was with a business associate, before going back and sitting down at the table. And just as he was about to start eating, the doorbell rang, because apparently no man can eat in peace anymore. Corris Waldeck peered towards the doorway as her husband stood up for the second time and walked towards the door. Months later, in evidence, At an inquest, she described what she saw, and I quote, "I saw a head in profile reflected against the frosted glass of the front door. The man was wearing a fisherman's cap with what appeared to be a pompon on top," unquote. Tom flicked on the entrance hall and stoop lights. He half opened the front door. The harsh crack of the pistol shattered the silence. Corus Waldock, in sudden panic, flung herself behind a chair. She peered nervously towards the half-open door. She said, and I quote, "I saw a man in a crowded position on the porch. He was holding a gun in his right hand. It was being fired, and I saw a flash." Three more shots had resounded through the house. Tom Waldock was slammed against the wall of the entrance hall. His right hand clutched his chest. Mrs. Waldock crawled towards her stricken husband, her eyes darting towards the porch. "My God, Tom, are you hurt?" she screamed. Well, what kind of question is that? Like, obviously the man is hurt. He's been shot. See, this is where I come in. I'll be like shouting, like, and you ask me that.
No, obviously no, no.
But anyway. So, Tom replied with, like, obviously, you know, he said, like, "Yes, I'm horribly hurt." And he cried for her to phone the police. I mean, yes, obviously. So she did. Corus Waldock did telephone the police and a doctor, but before they arrived, Thomas Ernest Holmes Waldock was dead. He had been shot twice. He had wounds in the chest and the back. The bullets had penetrated his liver, bowel, and spleen. And there's no coming back from that. Shortly after 7 o'clock on the night of the fatal shooting, Mr. A.W.T. Adams, a Johannesburg accountant, saw a large, dark car crossing an intersection, and it was traveling at a high speed and without lights. Now I know. Well, I don't know about you, but besides seeing a dark car speeding without lights, it's normal. It's like, okay, there goes another one. But back then, people like still took notice and found it suspicious. So let's get into a bit of Tom Waldock himself. Tom Waldock was a young man with young ideas. He described himself as a director of companies, talked big, and lived on a grand scale, providing his attractive wife and two sons with a sumptuous home in one of Johannesburg's most sophisticated northern suburbs. Young Tom, always on the move and always on the lookout for a quick profit business ventures, he had big ideas for a variety of profit-making schemes, from a mineral empire to a chain of bottle stores. Which I always like, by the way, bottle store is a liquor store. You were able to buy a business and own a business, I would go for a liquor store. I can't see how that would not work out. I mean, I've been to the smallest of small towns in my life. Like, literally, you don't even notice you're passing them. Like, three or four houses or something. But you will always find a liquor store. I swear those liquor stores are built before the houses itself. But anyway, he had built up a prospecting business on paper in the sandy wastes of Namaqualand. He planned to mine diamonds in a wide area of north of Portnoloth and had thoughts about giant diamond processing plants in Namaqualand. He had founded a Cordonia Development Company, a company that was registered in London. I mean, that's fancy. There was talk that the company had found rich deposits of base minerals. Perlite, used in the manufacture of lightweight building material, also fascinated Tom Waldock. In his active mind, he had plans for a multi-million rand perlite mining plant at Coast Mountain in Natal. I mean, go big or go home, I guess. In his search for perlite, perhaps the key to newfound riches, Waldock formed a company with Mr. G. Creer, a prospector and a Mr. Charles Richardson of London. You can fancy it. Waldeck and Richardson each had 37.5% of the shares, and Mr. Creer held the remaining 25%. Mr. Creer said subsequently in court that he had been told by Waldeck that Richardson could help him financially. Richardson was reputed to be a very rich man, but very little else was known about him at that time. I mean, apparently that's good enough. He's rich. Okay, that's all we need to know. It was estimated that he had put 200,000 rand into the company. Holy hell. How much 2,000 rand? 200,000 rand is back then? Whew. I wouldn't mind have that now even. Mr. Creer said it was estimated that there was 28 million tons of perlite on the site in the Limbombo Mountains of Northern Zululand, with perlite in its crude form fetching 6 rand a pound in London. The prospects for the three men appeared rosy. And 6 rand a pound? Damn! That's a lot of money in back then. The full story of the perlite venture was never told. All that was known was that after a time, the friendship between Waldeck and Richardson cooled. Although there were never appeared to be open, you know, issues between them. You wouldn't know that they had problems or they were having issues, because apparently all you need to know is that the man was rich and that's it. Yeah. After the sudden death of Waldeck, Richardson acquired his shares. Mr. Creer said he was asked to sign a paper in which Richardson retained his shares, but resigned as a director of the company. You know, is it getting sketchy yet? Because it should be getting sketchy. That was the last word on the Perlite project. It apparently came to nothing, but at least provided the police with a lead. And when they began their investigation into the shooting of Tom Waldeck. I mean, like, straight up, let's go to Richardson. Better go to Richardson. The murder probe began in the Diamond Desert of Namaqualand, but soon spread to other parts of the country and beyond the borders of South Africa. The investigation into the Waldeck killing became international. It was known that South African detectives were keeping in close touch with Scotland Yard. There was talk of investigation into the activities as well known London gang. But the police were not the only ones who probed the shooting. Dr. Gideon van Gas, a short and dapper Johannesburg insurance assessor and investigator, was asked towards the end of December 1965 to investigate the insurance claim on Waldeck's life. Waldeck had insured his life for 40,000 rand. Again, holy hell, that's a lot of money back then. Dr. Van Gas and his, by the way, obviously, better investigator, that's so much money. Dr. Van Gas and his fellow investigators went about their job meticulously. Only 8 days after receiving his instructions, Dr. Van Gas' investigations led him to Johannesburg nightclub. There he found a dark-haired, hollow-cheeked British immigrant named Johnny Bradbury. Dr. Van Gas and Bradbury had a heart-to-heart. According to evidence given later, Bradbury confessed to driving a getaway car used on the night of the Waldeck killing. He also said that a man named Gordon Winter had a gun used in the shooting. Winter, a 34-year-old reporter on a Johannesburg Sunday newspaper, was later held by the police under the 180-day detention law. With this valuable information in his notebook, Dr. Van Gas eagerly arranged a second interview with Bradbury and then a third in the lounge of a hotel in Hillbrow, Johannesburg. On the evening of January the 7th, 1966, about 6 months after the Walde killing, Dr. Van Gas and a fellow insurance assessor sat in the crowded hotel lounge, sipping drinks with Bradbury. Bradbury was talking freely. He said a man called Richard Aubrey had forced him to drive the getaway car by threatening to injure his family. He said, and I quote, "A cat that he had been under a severe threat and had no choice," end quote. That was the opinion, and that was what Dr. Gas said. Dr. Gas, of the stranger sitting opposite him, Bradbury said he had received only a lousy £25 for the drive. Lousy £25? How dare he? That's a lot of money. The shooting had been preying on his mind. He had even contemplated suicide. Okay. It was near closing time in the hotel lounge when five senior detectives walked to the table. They spoke briefly to Bradbury. He finished his drink, stood up, said a cheerio to his two table companions, and walked out, flanked by the five detectives. He was under arrest as a suspect in the murder of Tom Waldeck. I mean, what a way to go. Like, you're under arrest. Okay, well, cheerio. Here I go. Man. About 2 weeks after the arrest of Bradbury, Colonel C.W. St. John Pettle, a South African police officer, left for London. You know, back then, man, people had so many names. Woo! I'm so glad that has changed. Anyway, he had talks with Scotland Yard. Again, there were rumors that a London gang was connected with the killing. Members of the powerful gang were known. Sorry, there goes my notes. Members of, and my notes and my place with the other notes. What a thing. Members of the powerful gang were known to have been in South Africa at the time, or shortly before the murder. The gang, using a registered British company as a front organization, was believed to have supplied earth-moving equipment for certain mining projects in South Africa. Now, I didn't even know until doing research for this that gangs from that side would come this side. That's like, damn, okay, it's new to me. I don't know about you guys, but it's new to me. So, hold on. Sorry about that. When your office is in the bathroom floor, bound to be interrupted. Now, where were we? The London gang. Now, with what the police have learned, you know, the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle were slowly moving into place. It was obvious that Bradbury was not the only one connected with the killing, but he was the man in detention, and the spotlight was focused firmly on him. Born in June of 1932, he grew up in London's crowded, misty Soho district. School was a mere formality. The odd jobs to earn an extra penny were more important. A double tragedy struck him in the wild years of World War II. Both his parents were killed in an air raid, and the frail, dark-haired youngster was brought under the wing of a grandmother. Who doesn't love your grandmother? At the age of 14, the boy named John West left school and began a rather shaky career in the printing industry. He became an apprentice compositor. Okay, you know, things back then unique. There were other jobs, some quite profitable. But yeah, didn't work out so good as a barrow boy. You might suspect that the goods you handled were stolen, but you never asked awkward questions. And there he was. So he was a jack of all trades. A spell in the army had its moments, but the year 1954 was a memorable one for the young John West. He met an auburn-haired, blue-eyed young girl named Sheila. Sorry, I'm like stuck on the name Sheila. They were married after a slight hitch. John West had to produce birth certificate. It was a revelation to him. The name on the certificate was not John West, but Lawrence Bradbury. Now, that must be like a shock. Okay. You wanting to, I'm gonna make a passport or ID. Yeah, we get an ID when you turn like 16 to go make an ID. To find your birth certificate if you have one. I don't even have mine. But you go, just imagine, you go there like, okay, this has been my name. I've been Marissa Bones all my life. People call me Marissa Bones. And bam. You are Clarice. Fava beans. Can you just imagine that shock? Your life literally was a lie by then. So, with that revelation, and his new wife and new identity, the future looked brighter for the young Londoner. I mean, that's one way to look at it. It's not like his past was like all that good. He did some dodgy hood. So, yeah, I guess like take a new name, why not? There were always interesting people to meet in the streets and clubs of Soho who would help you pocket a few quid or more. The most influential and imposing of his newfound associates was Charles Richardson. Here was a man who wielded immense power, who had a finger in a lot of pies. Now, I preferred, like, I have a finger in a lot of ice cream. But we go with it, like, that is what it says. Well, not says, that's what everyone understands. If I'd be like, I had a finger in all of his ice cream bowls, no one would get it. Richardson persuaded Bradbury to manage a club called the Shirley Anne. It sold liquor after hours. Richardson's friend were frequent visitors to the club, and soon Johnny Bradbury, a 50-50 compromise between his old and new names, became to be regarded as one of the boys. Even then, that started. Okay. To be a member of the gang was not always plain sailing. Persuasion could be used in two forms. You could be threatened with disclosure of your past record. At this stage, Bradbury had several convictions for minor offenses. Sorry, but okay. Or you could be assaulted. The latter method preceded Bradbury's introduction into the second Richardson's business venture, the running of scrap metal business. Not a bit, like, I would also, if I was in his shoes and all those records against me, yeah, I'll choose a beating. Beat me. That's okay. So, with this, the business, and you know, all that smooth, not so smooth sailing, he persuaded him to work for nothing. His arms were mutilated with broken bottles and razor blades. Well, that changed, like, that went to a dark side quick. I mean, he went into his second business venture, you know, running scrap metal. And to persuade him to work for nothing, his arms were mutilated with broken bottles and razor blades. Because that's the type of job everyone wants, eh? Great. There were more business ventures. Good God, no. By now you should know you are horrible adventures. But the man continued. Bradbury and Richardson were associated in a wholesale business dealing in transistor radios. But to quote Bradbury, it was nothing but a swindle. Jeez, man, by now your whole life is a fucking swindle. On Richardson's orders, he opened a warehouse under the name Bradbury Wholesalers. In Bradbury's opinion, again, it was used by the gang to sell stolen property. Shocker. It was at this time, during one of his frequent visits to South Africa, that Richardson telephoned long distance to his youthful associate and informed him that Bradbury Wholesalers was under liquidation. And he said the police were looking for Bradbury. He suggested that Bradbury should come post haste to South Africa, otherwise he will end up in prison. That's a good thing. People have been coming here to hide for years. It's just that place to come. If you want to just disappear, South Africa is your place. Bradbury was in no position to argue. Take it or leave it, man. The big boss had spoken. He was soon in South Africa and was promptly appointed a director of a company known as Orange River Enterprises. He was in charge of the machinery for some mysterious mining operations. Mysterious, It was a gay life in South Africa. There were many round table drinking gum business meetings with associates of Richardson. At one of these meetings, Bradbury met young man about town, Tom Waldeck. There was some talk. It was alleged later by Bradbury that Waldeck be given large sums of money to bribe the government officials in regard of mining concessions. Bribing the 12th official language of South Africa. Christmas 1964, Bradbury returned to England to visit his family, but he had returned to Johannesburg before New York, and in less than 2 months he was in the Congo, fighting as a mercenary. I mean, damn, that man had a lot to do. That's a lot. He returned richer, by 2,400 rand to Johannesburg on April 8th, 1965. To settle down with his new immigrated wife in a house bought for them in northern Johannesburg suburb. But life was not without its complications. I mean, whose life is without complications? Please let me know. I would like to know. An article appeared in a Sunday newspaper that Bradbury had told a young woman to be Charles Wilson, a man implicated in one of the crimes of the century, the Great British Train Robbery. After reading this sensational disclosure, Bradbury was visited by crime reporter Gordon Winter. Winter said he would help him in suing the newspaper. Well, great stuff. I mean, show up, I'll help you sue people. What a way. What a way. Winter said, Winter took him to an attorney's home in Johannesburg. Richardson and one of his associates, Richard Aubrey, were also visitors. There's a lot of Richards. That visit set off a chain of events which had almost fatal consequences for the young Londoner and very definitely fatal consequences for the recently made acquaintance, Tom Waldeck. Yep, otherwise we would not have been here doing this. In mid-January 1966, Sheila Bradbury and her three children were on their way to England aboard the Windsor Castle. Their passage had been paid by the British consulate in South Africa. Johnny Bradbury had approached the consulate stating that he was destitute and that he wanted to get his wife and children to England. I get it. I want to leave this place as well. On board the liner, Sheila Bradbury was told that 3 days after they had sailed from Cape Town, her husband had been arrested on a charge of murder. Neatly dressed in a grey suit, the black-haired, lean young man who had already become the focal point of interest in South Africa and Britain appeared before a Johannesburg magistrate on January 10th, 1966, at a preparatory examination of an allegation of murder. He was told that he was to appear in court again on January 24th, and that he would be kept in custody. But in the meantime, Sheila Bradbury arrived in Southampton, only to be met by a team of detectives. They were doing like the Chris Hansen situation. You open your door, we'll have a seat. Lawrence Bradbury made his second appearance in the Johannesburg Magistrate Court, but the proceeding lasted only a few minutes, more than on the first occasion. That's a quick one. The court was told that the police were still investigating certain aspects of the Wahlbeck murder, and another was made by Attorney General of the Transvaal that Bradbury should not be released from custody until the end of all court proceedings in the interest of public safety and the maintenance of public order, which makes sense. I mean, if I was him in the community, I had to go back straight as quick as I possibly can to London. So it makes sense, you know? Do it. It was more than 2 months later that it was finally announced that Lawrence, okay, Johnny Bradbury, would appear at summary trial in Witwatersrand, local division of the Supreme Court in Johannesburg, on a murder charge. The date set for the trial was April 26, 1966. The mode of trial was decided on by the Attorney General. It meant that no evidence would be led till Bradbury appeared before a judge in the Supreme Court. 2 days before the trial, Sheila Bradbury returned to the country she had left less than 4 months before. She visited her husband twice, and he seemed to be very cheerful about it. Woman, stay where you are. Like, why you want to come back here? But who am I? What? Love is love. There was standing room only in the main criminal court on April 26 when Bradbury was due to appear before Mr. Justice Neyman and two assessors. The trial had attracted intense interest in Britain and South Africa. 5 British national newspapers had sent their representatives from London to report on the trial. With a host of local newsmen, they overflowed the press benches in the sombre courtroom. All eyes were on the man in the dock, on the black curly hair with a lock over the forehead, the hollow cheeks, the dreamy eyes, the slight body clothed in a blue suit and a shirt and a maroon tie and waistcoat. Because you need to look fancy as hell when you're like on trial for murder. Can't be looking like all disheveled. You need to be like, yeah, man. The mystery of his appearance in the dock was to be unraveled to them during the trial, and there was an atmosphere of expectancy and tension in the back public library. Gallery, library, dear Marissa, you need help. The whispered conversations speculating on the drama that would be unfolded were interrupted by a burly police orderly. Silence in the court, he roared. Like, I know it's like silence in the court, he roared, but I feel like, imagine like silence in the court, roar. But yeah, silence in the court, okay. The trial was about to begin. Bradbury pleaded not guilty, but the state presented a formidable barrage of evidence that was a murderer. Wahlbeck was killed at about 7 p.m. on June 29, 1965, at number 7 Aaron Avenue, Melrose, Johannesburg. He had been shot several times, but it was indicated at the start of the state case Bradbury had not fired the fatal shots. In fact, the full extent of Bradbury's participation in the killing was not known. Except the fact that he said he drove the getaway car, but you know. Mr. A.J. Kroch, state prosecutor, said it would be alleged that Bradbury was guilty as a socius criminis. When I looked this up, I'm like, do I have to say this word? Because I don't speak lawyer terms. Yeah. Example, as an accessory, yeah? So we just go here with like as an accessory. Bradbury at least drove a car and accompanied another man, the killer, to the house of Waldeck with the object of killing him. Obviously. Bradbury, it would be alleged, kept the car at the ready to facilitate an escape and that he drove away after the shooting. I don't think cars back then could be like, okay, let's hit it and you speed off. And then like, let's hit it and you start like, boom, 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 boom. Barely getting anywhere. Going nowhere slower. So, you know, car ready, gun in, let's giddy up. You know? Anyway, Bradbury, it would be alleged, kept the car, you know, ready to facilitate escape. And as they drove away with the shooting and everything, he shot as well. Oh, they heard shots. But who was the other man? And why didn't they hear more shots though? That is something they never cleared up. There's the shots. But back to, was the other man? The one who pulled the trigger. Not the shots they heard, but the trigger. Cool. No, Waldeck. Back to him. Stay on him. The state, in further particulars, presented to the court at the start of the trial and revealed him to be Harry Prince. Not to be confused with, like, Prince. Or Prince Charles, or Prince Harry, or any of them. Just saying. So, here comes a new person to story. As far as could be ascertained, there was nothing princely about Harry. Nothing princely? Were they expecting a man to walk in with a fucking crown? He was well known to the police. He was wanted by Scotland Yard, and he, according to the state case, had played the active part in killing of Tom Wallach. You see, if it was a what do they want with wasn't princely? Obviously, because he was like trying to escape the police. There's nothing princely about that. What about the murder weapon? It was identified in the first day of the trial as a Beretta pistol belonging to the Johannesburg journalist Gordon Winter. Damn, you can't trust journalists. Winter said he had bought the gun on the advice of a friend who borrowed it only a few hours before the shooting. Yes, because that's believable. This friend was Richard Aubrey. Okay, you know what? I take that back. Man who worked in the film world. Who knew people in the fringe of the underworld. Oh, okay. Might have just been like, not, but we do that. He was obviously, because you know obviously, a man of worth knowing. When you were a journalist, always on the hunt for a story. Okay, I'm not a journalist. I do hunt finding more information regarding cases, and especially like the ones I post on my Instagram page. How many cases are firstly not reported? Murder trial cases. Then names and anything. It's ridiculous. Maybe I need to find a. But no, he won't know any of this. Any. Never mind. So back to the journalist who's always on the hunt for a story. Aubrey had said, according to Winter, that large amounts of money were coming into South Africa. Winter said he came to know about visits to South Africa of Charles Richardson and other London businessmen. You know, that rich man. Which is just shady. He had a suspicion that the money they were investing in South Africa was connected with the Great Train Robbery. This was confirmed by Aubrey. Winter became well acquainted with Richard Aubrey and his associates, including Johnny Bradbury. Not to be confused with Johnny Bravo, just saying. Winter said he had been invited to a party at the home of Johannesburg attorney by Richard Aubrey. Aubrey had asked him to bring along Bradbury. Winter said he had suspicions that the visit was linked with some criminal intent. I mean, by now, obviously, everything these people be doing is criminal. But he had not known what had transpired between Bradbury and the other Londoners at the party, including Charles Richardson and Richard Aubrey. He had a certain trust in his Soho friends. For some weeks later, he lent his gun to Richard Aubrey. Unfortunately, Waldeck was killed with a gun on the following night. Who borrows their gun to someone? I mean, it's like I'm borrowing you my child. Here you go. You don't be borrowing people guns. First of all, it's illegal, obviously. Secondly, you know that is for some shady things. It's like, I'm gonna give you my gun. I'm borrowing you my gun. Cool, I know. Tomorrow the police will come and visit me. Make sure, you know. Well, not make sure, be telling me murder was committed. Now, with that said, we've already reached almost the 40-minute mark. And that is it for now. For this intriguing case with a lot of Richards. And no actual princes. But hey, it is what it is. We can't have it all. So, that being said, I would like to thank you, if you made it to the end, for listening to this episode, part one. You are absolutely legendary, and I appreciate each and one of you listeners. Please feel free to leave a comment or anything. Check out the page, truecrime.bones. Let me know what you think. And yeah, any tips or what you want to know. So, remember, stay safe. Crime never sleeps in South Africa. Ta-ta!